Okay. Welcome everyone to the first episode of this podcast. Today we will be discussing how to apply psychological frameworks mentioned in the Yoga Sutras along with contemporary psychological techniques, specifically cognitive behavior therapy. Cognitive behavior therapy is one of the most common methods used by psychologists, specifically to treat cases of depression, also some levels of schizophrenic thought. It involves an analysis of self-analysis of one's thought process, and by which one can overcome their misconceptions of reality and hopefully break the pattern of their habits. So that is cognitive behavior. That's what it broadly relates
to. So if my understanding of what you said is basically that that thought process is primarily stressing on a person trying to analyze their own thoughts. Is that a correct takeaway?
Yes, their own thoughts in along with the psychologist. A psychologist acts like a guide, okay, and helps them understand. But a lot of it does involve self-analysis, okay. Particularly, if you're trying to reason out why this is there, the psychologist might question your assumptions more, okay. An ideal psychologist should do that. Coming in terms of the broader framework, this is compared vis-a-vis psychoanalysis. Like Freudian psychoanalysis or a cognitive behavior therapy, they look at the same psychological analysis in different ways. So Freud believed in everything being unconscious or subconscious coming up. I mean, he does speak of different things like an id, an unconscious layer, a superconscious layer, a superego, id and ego. Three different states right. He talks of. And a psychoanalysis in a Freudian sense is someone who's trying to clear up the unconscious and bring it to surface so that the hidden problems are revealed. While in cognitive behavior therapy, you're looking at self-analysis and the patterns which exist. And the psychologist's role is to draw out the patterns. This is my understanding of these two commonly used therapies by psychologists today. What this discussion is about how Indian frameworks can give a deeper level of specificity vis-a-vis what technique to apply where for a particular person. As well as, so one framework which I've been using is from the Yoga Sutras. My references here come from BKS Iyengar, when his book on Light of the Yoga Sutras, as well as Sri Rama, Swami Rama, a controversial guru, and whose knowledge was very insightful. I found this resource called Tripura Shakti website. It had a lot of very precise descriptions of the different terminologies involved in the Yoga Sutras. So these are my sources when it comes to the Yoga Sutras. I also use personalized astrological readings to integrate, to get a deeper analysis of a person's psychology. Okay. And that is something which we'll cover more in the later podcast on how to analyze a person's psychology using their astrological birth charts. Now coming back to the Yoga Sutras. Okay. So there's this document which I shared with my friend who is in this discussion with me. Ramana, thanks a lot for cooperating with me. That's a pretty long introduction and thanks a lot for being with me here. And we will be discussing on how these different techniques as well as descriptions can be used to get a more specific reading of a person. Okay. We have many, many ways of looking at things. Fundamentally, this philosophy, yoga or Sankhya as they're known together, yoga Sankhya is a specific school of Indian psychology which looks at a individual consciousness and tries to make the aim of this particular philosophical school is to transcend the dualities of what it calls as the Purusha and the Prakriti. Okay, Purusha being the observing witness of all of creation, and Prakriti being this dynamic creation in itself. As per the Sankhya Yoga, I will be using yoga to keep it simpler, to keep things simple. We are all part of Prakriti. All of us are consciousness. And we are come from this non-dual Purusha, which is simply an observer or a seer, someone who is able to see everything, who is just an observer looking at everything without any emotion, nonchalantly looking at it. Okay. The reason.
So, in some sense, the Purusha is a concept of some kind of observing God, like non-acting, but I mean, separate from the entire universe. The universe being the Prakriti. Would that be a correct framing of it?
I don't know if it's a separateness. It's like, can you separate consciousness and activity? Okay, it's like something which is conscious and something which is outward driven. Okay, so they're both together, right? Like a woman and a man together. Okay, so it is just the man, the Purusha is the male principle of consciousness, while the female principle is the gives room for that consciousness to expand. Okay, sort of. So we have this universe, right? Take the Big Bang, for example. We know that the universe is expanding all the time, right? But mm-hmm. there has to be a void for it to expand into.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's both. It involves the dynamic principle, which is conscious of itself, the Purusha, and how the Prakriti is what enables it to expand and to grow and to be this diverse form which we observe today. Specifically, Indian philosophy generally regards the dynamism and it believes that these are certain afflictions which are caused by normal human beings. Okay, for a normal human being, it is considered ideal for them to remove these afflictions or kleshas. Okay,
so what is the affliction that you're talking of? I mean, are we talking of, say, the conventional meaning of it, say, some addictions or say, some. Say problem with the sight, or I mean, what do you specifically mean? With afflictions.
Let's put it this way: is when we feel something is disturbing us, when we are not in harmony or in peace or balance, then we know something is afflicting us, or we are not in a state of joy. Okay. The description given is the Purusha. If you are at the level of the Purusha, enjoying the Prakriti, right? You're in a state of absolute bliss all the time. And the only reason we don't enjoy this absolute bliss is because we have these different layers of coloring which have come between us and this absolute bliss, which is called the kleshas, which are called the kleshas. So now, even if a person is, say, blind, dumb, deaf, they're still, you could argue it's a physical affliction, right? But what about their inner state? Are they truly afflicted?
Right. Okay. So your point being that it's about the internal balance. Whatever is disturbing the internal balance, only that would be termed as an affliction or a klesha. I mean, it's not the physical affliction in itself, right?
Give me a minute. I'm just thinking of some specific thing. It is not a form-based affliction, okay? It is like, when you're talking about physical, right? You're talking about it in terms of a form, okay? So it could even be that the greatest inner pain also you experience, but still it doesn't bother you. You're still in a state of balance. You might feel pain, but you still are in a state of balance, harmony, and you just are in that state of bliss. So it's like awareness at different levels of consciousness. So if you're blind, for example, and you walk in the road, you might trip over and fall. Okay. But neither the tripping bothers you nor the fall, nothing bothers you. You still might feel the pain of it. Okay. But you're at a level where it doesn't matter. You just are. Okay. You just are bliss.
Right.
Okay. So it's not like a person who is absolutely transcendent, does not experience all of this. It's just that they're able to look at it with a certain sense of detachment or as a play, right? They're able to observe everything as an interaction of all of these different forces, psychological states, planets, Navagrahas, whatever you wish to call it. They're able to view it as an interaction of all these dynamic elements within us. They're fundamentally, they are the observers. And all of this dynamic interaction within us is like a play for them.
Right, right.
Okay, so it's just the ability to look on anything and everything with a sense of joy and of play. Okay, I mean, you could possibly relate it to concepts like the Ras Leela or Krishna Leela, exactly, which where you're able to focus on the world as a play of the divine in itself. Okay, so that's another way you could possibly link up these different conceptions of what an ideal state should be. Okay, so coming now to these colorings, the first, very first coloring, as they call it, is called avidya. In Sanskrit, vidya is knowledge, a is a negative prefix, so this is avidya, which clearly shows that it is a lack of knowledge, or something has come up. Maybe some part of us has gone to sleep. Okay, there is a notion called the gunas, which we are coming into now. Slowly we are entering into, from undifferentiated bliss, we are entering into differentiated qualities, if you will, of creation. Okay, so the first guna which is set to materialize is tamas. Okay, this tamas is the darkness, or is a certain veiling, if you will, okay, of that absolute bliss. Okay, and that veiling is what is causing this separation, if you will, okay, of the bliss and of our state. Okay, and immediately as soon as the first veiling starts, we have the next klesha coming up, which is the I-ness. Not even I, I'm not talking about I am, but just I, the notion of an I. Okay, what most Indian schools of philosophy believe, that is, the I itself is impermanence, it's an illusion. Okay, and there is a certain, the I-ness itself is just us in a particular transitory state. If you want to take it in a very high-tech simulation of what we are, maybe we are all living in part of a simulation. Okay, that's one way of looking at it. Okay, and the simulation, we are all different characteristics just interacting with each other, and we produce a lot for this, you could say, one programmer or creator, if you will. Okay, but the I-ness is said to be an illusion. So if you're able to transcend the sense of I-ness and go to the maybe the master program, if you will, okay, and you're able to see the how the all of these interactions come together. So now we come to the second layer, asmita, or just the so I-ness.
This level you're talking of is basically me as part of that simulation, breaking away, or like going above that and trying to understand the reality outside of the simulation.
Oh, I don't even know if it is a question of understanding, right? Because our understanding itself is limited. We just are in bliss, that's all. I mean, I would say even understanding is a knowing and not knowing are two sides of the same coin, right?
Right.
Okay, so it's like you go past the dualities of vidya and avidya and you just are. Okay, it doesn't matter. It's just a play, right? Would you like to, if you're playing a game, would you just like to know about how you're playing all the time, or is it learning? It's just play, right? It's just fun.
Right.
Okay, it's not serious. It's just, maybe when you talk of knowledge and knowing and understanding, it takes on a lot more gravitas and seriousness, etc. Okay. And coming back to the asmita, after the asmita is the asmita of the I-ness, that's when the first conceptions of an individual start coming into place. So the most fundamental is supposed to be the buddhi, the analytical part, the analyzing, the decision-making part of consciousness. Okay, so that is called as the buddhi. There's also the chitta. Okay, the chitta is the, you could say, the mind stuff. All of this, right, all of this is suspended, all of our interacting dynamics is suspended in something which they call as a mind stuff. It's like, think of it as a liquid solution in which you dissolve different particles, or you're conducting a chemical reaction. It's like a medium, if you will. Okay, it's like a medium in which all of these interactions are going on. It is a storage in which you're bought into. Okay, all of the chitta is supposed to have two parts. Ramana, interrupt me if I'm going too technical or I'm going off track. Okay, if it's too technical, right, please interrupt. Okay, so this chitta consists of two parts. One is a passive layer consisting of all of our memories or everything that we've ever experienced. I'm not going into reincarnation now, but if you believe in reincarnation, it could be that everything you experienced ever since you were created, or the so-called I was created, has been stored in the chitta. Okay, and often a memory surprises us, right? We have so many impressions which we never knew were conscious suddenly come up, crop up within us actively. So all of this is what comes from the passive layer of the chitta. The active layer of the chitta is where all of our psychological traits are interacting with each other. My particular take on this chitta is, we will go into this later, is there are multiple astrological charts which describe about the different layers of consciousness, our ability to be, our psychology in different situations are given in astrological charts. And I think the storage or the set of interactions of the astrological charts are stored in the chitta. This is my personal belief. Okay.
So, and, yeah, tell then me. chitta is more of a medium. The storage of, I mean, it's where all the experiences of the conscious have been stored. And buddhi is the capability of intellect. Would that be right?
Buddhi is like this, yes, the discerning, the cutting and the categorizing part of the mind is called the buddhi. Not the mind, okay, of this, I will use a word either, they call it, the mental functions are all clubbed together in a word called antakarana, okay. So they use that word for that. The mental functions, Western psychology typically uses a single word mind, right, to cover all of our mental functions.
Right.
Okay, in India we call antakarana or the inner mind as the is a broader sense. So we've covered two already, buddhi and chitta. We have two more to cover now, which is called the manas and the ahamkara. Okay, we will now go to the ahamkara. So we earlier spoke about this asmita and the I, right? Okay, but that's just a notion of an I. It doesn't take on any identity as an I. Now all of us, as a normal human being, I mean most normal human beings, have certain identities, right? We might think of ourselves as male or female or transgender or any other gender. We might think of ourselves as a name. We are attached to our names itself, right? And we might think of ourselves as born in a particular country. I've studied in it. So all of these identities which are taken on is called the ahankara. Okay. The moment we take on identity, that's when desires or repulsion start coming into play. Then we go back to the kleshas, where we find two commonly known as pleasant and unpleasantness, raga and dvesha. Okay, so we find certain things we identify with, certain things we don't identify with, which are pleasant and unpleasant to us. Okay, and we come to the last klesha, which is also called as abhinivesha. Okay, so anything which we are pleasant, we try to gravitate towards it, right? We try to secure it, we are afraid that we might lose it. Okay. Or anything unpleasant, we try to avoid it and make sure we don't experience it or throw it away as far as possible. The klesha which is responsible for this is the abhinivesha. Okay. And now that we've covered, so from the time we start having an ahankara, all of these kleshas come into play. Now, is this all bad? Traditionally, we've always believed, I mean, a lot of common Indian belief is to, you know, do away the ahankara. Don't use your ahankara. That's a common phrase, if you will. I don't know if you've come across that. But
right.
A lot of it is very negatively treated in terms of the ahankara, because it is considered to be the greatest obstacle in terms of achieving a higher truth. Okay. We've covered the kleshas. We've covered most of the components of the mental space or the antakarana. We finally go on to the manas. In Sanskrit terminology, the manas, strictly speaking, refers to something called the sense mind. Okay. The sense mind is all about how you process the information given to you by your various sense organs. The Sanskrit term is called jnanendriyas. Jnana, knowledge, indriya, senses. So it's called jnana indriya. Okay. So specifically coming, this is the manas. Okay, the manas is what is the more emotional part of it. It generates the emotions along with the chitta. Okay, the manas and the chitta interact together to give us the emotions or emotion. Okay, and how we make sense of the world. Indian psychology in particular looks at a lot at manas in terms of the moon rashi is very important. Astrologically, we analyze things from the moon rather than the sun, which is considered to be a symbol of the ahamkara. We tend to look at the moon and in a lunar sense in terms of how a particular person's mental makeup is. Okay, something which we can elaborate on maybe in a later podcast. Coming back now, this ahamkara, as I said earlier, is viewed negatively. All of it, particularly the ahamkara, all of these kleshas which I spoke of, right, they're all considered negatively, right, in terms of afflictions and as something being away from that absolute pure state. Now, the key is, how do we get ourselves to make ourselves more happy in this particular world? That is the whole purpose of therapy. And I'm saying even Indian psychology can help us understand how to make us happier in this world. Okay, the way I approach Indian psychology is not to say that nothing is possible, we can't be happy in this world, and that we should look only to the afterworld for happiness. That is something which happens a lot, right? I mean, typically a lot of Indian philosophy, or a lot of Indian people believe that, you know, they just want to do good and live happily ever after, maybe in some heaven or have a good fortunate next birth. Okay, commonplace people do think, speak of it like that. Okay.
Right, right.
The key is, what can we do now? I'm approaching this from a more problem-solving point of view. What can we do now to keep ourselves happy, more aware, grow in knowledge, grow within ourselves? Now, fundamentally, I understand, as someone who's practicing this, is I'm looking at it from an asmita point of view. I'm not transcendent the asmita or even the ahankara, possibly, because I'm still looking at it as in terms of an I. Okay, so that itself shows my personal ajnana or ignorance, if you will, because I don't have knowledge of anything beyond that. Okay, so I'm approaching it this way for most normal human beings. Maybe saints or someone who advanced beyond, they might have a different conception of this altogether. They might say that it's better for you to cross everything completely and then come back in through the different layers from the highest possible consciousness. Okay, and for me, is fundamentally kleshas are supposed to be, all the kleshas which you've spoken of already, they're all supposed to cause a lot of distress. They are supposed to cause the different mental states in our mind. Okay, we have five different mental
Kleshas, the kleshas, just for a recap, we had spoken of were avidya, asmita, raga, and dvesha, right?
And abhinivesha.
Abhinivesha.
Yeah. I'd spoken of abhinivesha when we had come to the point of avoiding raga and dvesha, right? Avoiding dvesha and trying to secure the raga which you have. So it is that added layer of fear on top of fear on top of dvesha, added layer of desire on top of raga, the securing instinct. So that is abhinivesha. Abhinivesha is also seen as the fear of life, of living. You want to live, right? I mean, most people would want to live. Okay. Right. That survival instinct, if you will. Okay. So now all of these raga, the interaction of the raga, of the kleshas and the different buddhi components give rise to certain mental states. Okay. So there are five different mental states which are talked, which are spoken about in terms of the Yoga Sutras. Now the key...
So you're saying that it's, like before getting there, you're saying that it's on the basis of the interaction of the kleshas, the five that we had counted, with, say, the buddhi, the chit, the manas, interaction with those, correct?
Yes. So, yeah, it is based on the interaction of all this. Okay, these particular afflictions and how they affect the different inner components of our mental state, how they affect it. That's what leads to different mental states. Am I clear?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So going on to the mental state, the most basic state is supposed to be when we are very disturbed. Okay. Shipta. Okay. We are very disturbed internally and we can't do anything, right? If you're that disturbed or agitated, there's no possibility of thinking beyond. Okay. It might be a very agitated rajas state. Okay. Where you cannot contemplate anything beyond it, right? It's typically when we are afraid of losing something which we have. Something when we are afflicted by abhinivesha in particular, it is then that we are not able to carry out any task. And this is considered to be the most disturbed state of the mental states. Okay, it is a very rajasic state based on abhinivesha, where we are so scared maybe for our survival or something that we are so intensely involved, we cannot do process anything else. So when you are intensely afflicted with fear, right? Is it possible for you to think of anything else?
No, it's not correct. So, there is a certain kind of paralysis, so to say, of the body, or it's as if we lose control of the body and like we are going on its own.
We are not
consciously taking any.
Yeah, you're not consciously taking it. I mean, maybe the fight or flight response also could come here. Okay, maybe when you have that level of adrenaline running through, it could be like the fight or flight response. Okay.
Next,
we come into the when the mind is not agitated, but it is just very inert. Okay, it is not capable of doing anything, and that is called the muda. Okay. It is just bland. It is just, it's a very, nothing is possible in that state. It's not an agitated state though, but you just are dull. You just are, this is something which a lot of Indian references are there, right? Or blind mooda nambike in Tamil, as you would call it. Okay.
Is it the feeling that I have on a Sunday afternoon? not wanting to do anything?
Yes. Yeah, quite true. Depends on what's caused that stupor. But yes, quite true.
Right.
Possible. Okay, and then we come to the first state, okay, which is a mental state related to the manas. When we start sensing things, right, we are always in a very active mind. When you're trying to perceive, when you're trying to anticipate desire, when we're trying to acquire something, right, we are easily we are not focused. It is a desire based state, right? We are attentive, for example, when we want to acquire something. Okay, it is a rajasic state in the sense of it is the active state, right? It is a very active state, desire-oriented state. And it is a very sense-based state. You're looking around your environment, trying to see what it is that you're trying to acquire. But you're also distracted because all you're doing is you're searching for something. You're not focused. It's not a focused mental state, right? But at least there's a certain awareness of this particular state, and that helps you to be trained. So this state is called the vikshipta. Okay. So it is related to the sense mind. So at the basic level, it's related to the sense mind. Next, we go on to, once you start analyzing your inner states, right, using your buddhi, okay, it goes on to what you would call is ekagra, okay, a concentrated mind which is focused, which can keep its mind in one track. I think for the current day and age, I think vikshipta and ekagra are both very important. I mean, I don't know at least about you, but at least I tend to browse a lot at times. I do a lot of random browsing. It is just a very mentally, what I would call, it's a distraction for me. I'm just mentally passively looking out for something, that's all. So, for example, when we are zoning in and out of so many different mental activities, right, there's a lot more vikshipta likely to be involved rather than this ekagra, the single-pointed consciousness. Okay, and this vikshipta is something which we should actively work on, because does it really allow us to do anything? Yes, we can do our day-to-day activities done, but are we really happy, and don't we feel drained out or tired when we've just involved ourselves, mentally being so stimulated all the time?
And this is also connected with the general problem of short attention spans that we've been hearing about as well.
I think so. Because we are so in such a strongly stimulated age, right? Okay, everything is like a desire. You want to do so many different things. And if it's particularly out of desire, okay, it is going to keep your mind going on and on. I don't know, but would you say your concentration is equally when you're able to... Wasn't there a difference in the concentration levels when you're doing one thing at a time in a steadfast manner vis-a-vis many things which you want to accomplish all the time?
Right. I mean, yes, my concentration would be significantly better when I'm doing one task focused approach. And I also do see that the tendency is a lot rarer now, where I have a tendency to move from one task to another without necessarily completing that task first.
So you're right. I mean, we live in a time where there's a lot more vikshipta. A lot of us are pretty distracted. And this is something which is not considered ideal. It is just seen as a state by which, but it, the positive thing is this is considered to be a state in which we can be trained to achieve a concentrated state like ekagra. Okay. So that's the positive about this particular state compared to a mooda state where people are completely passive or inert, or even completely where they're agitated or disturbed. Tikshapta is considered to be more positive compared to these two things because there is a certain awareness which can be used for training to the ekagra state. In the ekagra concentrated state, it is when you're using your buddhi to analyze. Okay, and when you use your buddhi to analyze, and sattva is generally, I bring to the gunas which we have not explored so much, I'm bringing in the word sattva compared to the guna, sattva, rajas, tamas. We've explored tamas and rajas, we are coming to sattva now. Sattva is all about the ability to throw light on something. Okay, rajas, a lot of our work, day-to-day work is rajasic because it's very interactional and transactional, right? A lot of work has become very transactional. Sattva is when you're able to actually throw light on a particular situation. Okay, now we do
would
need
it be what corporate speak is about, like having the bigger picture? Would you call it as that?
It can give you the bigger picture, it can give you creativity, it can give insight. Okay, sattva is many things. Like when you're in that state of balance and harmony, definitely one way to look at it is you can see the big picture, the strategy, if you will, of visualizing what is going on. Okay, see, your ability to take the big picture and to visualize is also sattvic. It also, the creative inspiration you have can be considered to be sattvic. Okay, also the sense of, you would say when you're emotionally able to regulate yourself, okay, that also can be considered sattvic. So when you're able to regulate your emotions, so when you're distracted, right, you're likely to move towards a more agitated state if you don't get what you desire, right?
Right.
Okay. So instead of being distracted and moving to agitation, if you are at ekagra, you might be able to regulate your emotions better. Now, I've used three different notions of sattva. One is this big picture, as you mentioned. One is the ability to create, innovate, etc. And the ability to regulate your emotions. All these three I've clubbed under sattva. I've used a certain planetary configuration on this. Basically, the sattvic planets, Jupiter, Moon, and Sun. We will explore these in further podcasts. Okay. And finally,
can you tell a bit more about the ekagra state of mind? Because that seemed to be particularly interesting, and maybe in some sense, the desired state of mind, one would want to be in that kind of a state of mind for a longer period.
Okay. I think the key is ekagra the ultimate goal? Okay. Or is ekagra sustainable?
It may not be, but it's at least, it's like exercising. I mean, you can't be exercising 24 hours in a day. But agreed, it's good to be exercising for maybe half an hour or 1 hour in a day, right? So in that limited sense, if one would want to be in the focused state or the ekagra state for even a brief period, how do you think that one should go about doing it?
Okay. I will briefly mention this. We will go, when we are going to the last section, which is the vrittis, which we are talking about, there we will deal about this more. Okay,
sure.
But you're right, there are certain advantages to have a sattvic buddhi and a concentrated pointed state of mind. I think it's better we deal with it at the vritti, at the last, in the next stage of the conversation.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And the final state is considered to be nirodha, okay, which is where you have all of the mental functions under your absolute control. Maybe this could be equivalent to the purusha state I was talking about, where you can consciously, you would say, I don't know the word manipulate is correct, but rather you are completely aware of what your mental states are. It's completely under control. One, I've never gone to Nirodha, so I don't know if I can describe it. Okay, but at least from the descriptions I've read, they're suggesting that it is something where you're completely aware. Like ekagra, like you rightly mentioned, we can't sustain it all the time. I mean, you could call it exercise, it's concentrated. It is a certain, for me at least, I would experience it as a more intense state, which I can sustain for some time, but I cannot be in a state of ekagra all the time. Okay. Maybe nirodha is considered to be the absolute state, where we are completely in line with our mental functions, and it's absolutely under our control. Now, what is that which controls in? Is it R which controls, or is it just a state of consciousness? I think that's a question which is beyond me to answer at this particular point in time. Okay. It could just be that the sense of I itself need not be there at all, right? In a conventional sense, okay, if you don't have a sense of an I, then maybe you are absolutely aware. if you completely give up everything, that's when you have everything. Okay, so
no, can you repeat that part?
It's like you're hanging on to something, you're hanging on to your identity, right? Okay, and there's a certain universal identity which you are not a part of. Okay, to attain that universal identity, you have to break down your own sense of identity. A breakdown is a wrong word. Maybe that's why you call about, I'm slightly diverging here, but you talk about the different paths towards God, right? You have the Bhakti Marga, or the path of devotion. You have the path of knowledge, the Jnana Marga, and you have the path of karma, Karma Marga, the path of work, or even some people use Raja Yoga, etc., as different paths toward God. All of this is so that you attain the supreme state and you break, you sort of remove this. It's like taking clouds and dispersing away the clouds, and you come to that clear, blissful state. Okay. So the moment you come and you break all of these boundaries which you have, it's like because you're an individual, you have so many boundaries, right? Like you can move only your own body. You can't do anything else. Even your own body, you can't move all the time. Okay. In all the ways you want to. There are certain limitations and boundaries which you have taken up. Okay. Which because we are part of an individual human being. The moment we are able to go beyond an individual human being. Okay. That's when we can potentially see everything, all mental functions as they are. So I spoke earlier about how this Purusha witnesses the interaction of all the different functions, right? Okay, maybe that is the state in which Nirodha is, where you're able to clearly see how the Purusha interacts with all of the different states. Sorry, how the different mental states interact with each other.
Right.
Okay. And we finally go to the last thing, which is actually pretty fundamental in the Yoga Sutras. The second line of the Yoga Sutras is all about Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Okay, the function is all we are trying to bring the Chitta, which is the storage of all of our memories, sensations, samskaras, as you will. The word samskara means all of the impressions which you have in your passive memory. You are trying to bring it to a rest. That is the Chitta. Okay, that is the Chitta Vritti Nirodha. And there are different mental states which are described. Not mental states, this passive state within us, right? It's said to have five different movements. So now we've spoken about the different mental states earlier. We've spoken about the different afflictions, colors in which we view this. Okay, the kleshas we've spoken about. Now, what is that which actually, we've spoken of chitta as the mental stuff, right? It's like the medium in which all of this is suspended, right? Okay, now what is this? How does the medium move in itself? And what is that cause? Now, that is what we'll see in the last section, chitta, the vrittis of chitta. Okay, the very first, I will start off is with pramana, which is considered to be correct perception. Now, this pramana is a very controversial topic in the sense every school of thought in the Indian philosophical system has certain different ideas of pramana. Okay, pramana is considered to be right thought, right perception. Now, what is right and how does it become right is a bit tricky. Since you're looking at the Yoga Sutras, I will go to what the Yoga Sutras specifically say, but this varies among the different schools of Indian philosophy. What is considered to be correct is that which is directly experienced, that which is mentioned in the scriptures like the Vedas, okay, and that which can be inferred, inferences like smoke and fire, right? If you see smoke, there is likely to be fire. Now, that's an inference. So, these are the different basic three items of pramana, which is considered to be correct perception. Okay, and this is considered, now the problem is we have to tune ourselves to correct perception, right? Are we perceiving correctly all the time? In an objective reality, right? If you and I are interacting, we can point out and say both of us are trained in the same way and we can say there is a yellow chair. Both of us agree that it is a yellow chair. But if someone has not been exposed to the color yellow or does not know what a chair is, their perception of it is completely different, right? Okay. So they will just look at it as an object. So now what is this correct perception? Is there any such thing as a correct perception?
No, the yellow I see is the same as the yellow you see.
Point taken. Yeah, definitely. We can bring in different levels of subjectivity. Okay. That is also true. Like So you're bringing in more subjectivity, which is very true. So the subjectivity can go further into, if I were to give you a room and I would ask you to notice a set of objects, what you notice and I notice would be very different. Okay. So is there such a thing as correct perception? A stance taken by many schools is that in this world, as long as you're under the influence of the eye, the kleshas, as long as your mental layer is covering, there is no such thing as correct perception. And the only perception is either viparyaya, which is considered to be incorrect perception, or vikalpa, fantasizing. Okay, so we'll go on now to pramana, but I mean from a more practical purpose, right? So I'm taking a very workable definition, if you will, of pramana. So I'm saying at a basic level, you and I might agree that there is a chair. Okay, that there is a yellow chair. Okay, so we might agree on that. And that too, we are reasonably similar. We've been taught the color yellow. So within the bandit of the color yellow, right, you and I have a certain agreement on, broad agreement on that. So it's a working hypothesis, right, if you will. Okay, so using this notion of a working hypothesis, to train up correct perception, we should first train up our buddhi. And this coming back to the ekagra part, which you were mentioning earlier, right? Okay. How do we get to a more concentrated state so that our perceptions of the world become correct? Okay, we go on to another vritti called smriti. Okay, all of our impression, all of our memory, right, when we come up, when we are trying to say a yellow colored chair, we have a memory of what is a chair and we have a memory of the color yellow. Right, so we are bringing up those two memories and we are then analyzing it, we are presenting it to our intellect, and that intellect is what is analyzing both of these categories, right? So we come to the smriti or the memory of a person. Okay, the memory is even in as basic a thing as this. So now when we are, say, in an office situation, right, when we have to make a, say, assessment of a particular person, we have to, what comes to our mind is what will affect our judgment of while giving that person's, as while assessing a person, correct? Okay, now what is it that causes this? Can we now be at a state of ekagra while we are doing an assessment? Can we be at a state of being as neutral as possible while we are making an assessment or any type of analysis? Now, why is this neutral considered to be more of an ideal? Okay. In a basic level, neutrality implies a lack of identification. So, we spoke earlier about the ahankara, right? How it causes the raga and the dvesha, pain and pleasure, and our fear around pain and our desire around pleasure. All of these give certain intensity of feelings which cloud our judgment even more, right? Which cloud the buddhi even more. Okay. And these broadly are referred to as colors. Okay. The clouding of the buddhi is referred to as the coloring of the buddhi. And as we make the colors more and more neutral, we are able to see all the different colors. So think of a crystal, right? A red color crystal can only show us the color red. But if you have a crystal which is crystal clear, it can show us all the different colors when we view through it. Okay. And that helps us, I would say, that is a worthy goal fighting for me, because I would like to be as honest as possible in terms of our judgment. I mean, that's something which humans would aspire to, right? To have an honest, non-prejudiced judgment. Okay. And that's where I say that making our perception, memories more neutral, making our perceptions more neutral, all of this leads to a greater state of ekagra, and it leads to a certain, if you will, clarity in terms of our perception. So our perception is more likely to be correct in pramana. And again, as you mentioned earlier, this is a working hypothesis, since there is no absolute truth, is what our schools believe in. But what is truth as far as we know, as far as our pramana allows us, that we can do it by being as neutral as possible. Okay, and once our memories, our smriti also becomes more neutral, we are able to visualize things better, and we are able to act correctly and do the right thing, if you will. I'm taking a more moral stance, but at least we are able to act with discernment. The word being viveka, which comes in here, we are able to act with more discernment as and when our smritis come in. So we've covered two of the vrittis, chitta vritti, we've covered pramana and smriti. I hope the ekagra interrelation with this is clearer now. Hello? Hello? Hello. Ramana, I think your mic is switched off.
Can you hear me now? I think that this is clear. Hello.
Yeah, this is clear. Your mic was switched off. Yeah. Huh, so it was clear. The ekagra linkage with the ekagra linkage along with the chitta vrittis was clear.
Yes, it was.
Okay, cool. So now we move on to the other vrittis. One is we spoke of muda, right? And you spoke of the stupor and a Sunday afternoon, which is true. As in, our mind, even when we talk about vikshipta, okay, when we are distracted, right? It's because our minds become a blank and we are not able to do something, right? One, we are at a stupor, but it also means when we are distracted, it means that our mind cannot complete a task at one point in time. It becomes completely blank, right? So now, what is this which makes our mind blank? Okay, that blankness, right, is called nidra. More conventionally, nidra refers to sleep, a state where we are completely blank, where there is nothing, where there's no mental movement, except for this is also being categorized as a mental movement, saying that, hey, this sleep is also a certain movement of our mental processes. Okay, this is most closely connected with the muda and the vikshipta mental states. Okay, and then we come
But
to
sorry,
yeah.
so here the blank state is in a slightly negative connotation, and in a lot of other contexts, being in a blank state is considered to be in a positive connotation. Would that be right? And why is there a difference in the connotation here?
Could you tell me the connotation in which blankness is exposed in the positive? I can think of it in Buddhism, where we talk about the Shunyavada, specifically about
But
Hinduism
a
in
lot of
India.
meditation, I
Mindfulness.
mean, yeah, so a lot of mindfulness is my understanding is that it is talking about letting it be, letting the ideas flow, and like just eventually moving to a state of zero thoughts, not consciously, but like not putting in any efforts towards having any thoughts, and thereby moving in a direction of being in a completely blank state.
Okay, specifically there is, it is about a flow, right? So you're blank and all you can visualize or observe is a certain flow of thoughts. When you become blank and when you become the observer, you're observing the flow of stream of thoughts. There's no consciousness. Where my understanding of Buddhism, of course, is that when you come to that blank, that mindful state, you just observe as everything is a flow and there is only a void. There's only a shunya, right? There's nothing else. Right, and everything is just seen as
Right.
a flow which is not there, nothing really exists at all. Everything is interdependent on each other, and nothing really exists.
Right.
Okay, so that is an active blankness. See, everything is still moving, everything is dynamic. You've become a blankness in itself, but here in the muda and the nidra, it is not in you're not aware that you're blank, right? You just blank.
Right.
Okay, you are just blank. There's no nothing flowing. There's no sense of the dynamism or interaction of all the other forces coming together. Buddhism has the doctrine that you can view everything coming as an interaction of everything. Okay, when you come to the blankness, you view everything in terms of a flow. Okay, oh, the environment, the thoughts, it observes you to observe the river of thoughts, right? And that river of thoughts slowly comes to a halt as and when you observe it.
Right.
Okay, so specifically that is allowing the river of thoughts to come to a specific halt, but this is a complete, but when you are asleep, it is not the river of thoughts coming to a halt. So we have also a concept called yoga nidra, where you're consciously sleeping. Okay, for nidra, I think the counterpart to a more, the Hindu counterpart to, let's say, this nidra as a blankness would be yoga nidra, where it is consciously aware sleeping, which is considered to be a more meditative state or more aware state. But at a normal human level, this nidra is viewed in a slightly negative connotation because there is no awareness, right? There's no consciousness. There in a Buddhist state, you are consciously aware of the flow and of the interaction. Here, you're not aware. You're just blank. When you're in a stupor, you're just blank, right? There's nothing you can do. You're just dull.
Right.
Okay. So, coming back. Now, we've covered Nidra, we've covered Smriti, we've covered Pramana. Okay, these are the different vrittis of Chitta. And then we are going on to Viparyaya and Vikalpa. Viparyaya is considered to be incorrect perception. Okay. It is considered to be incorrect because in certain, again, this is in a very worldly quality of the world. Okay, let's take this as a day-to-day working hypothesis where you observe something incorrectly. And this is considered typically to be a more rajasic where your desire is clouding your perception. Okay, and you see something which is actually not. Okay, so as compared to the sattvic way of correct perception, a rajasic way of viparyaya is considered to be in a negative connotation because it shows that your desire is distorting the reality of that particular object. Okay, and the cause for this viparyaya is because yes, you don't have knowledge of either yourself or of that particular object. You don't have, that is called avidya is the particular cause of this viparyaya. Okay. And finally, we come to vikalpa, which is imagination. And vikalpa is considered both ways. Okay. I mean, sometimes you could get completely lost in your fantasy world. You could just lose yourself and be out of touch with the day-to-day reality. But also it is a source of new thoughts, new creations, etc. So it is a bit, it could lead. So even your daydreams, right? Or if you have a nightmare, both of them, for example, if you have a nightmare, it could lead to a shipta mental state, which is where you're agitated, etc. Or a distracted mental state where your daydreams keep intruding on whatever work you have to do. Okay. Again, the cause of this is seen as avidya. Okay. And avidya is seen as a cause because it is, let's say you're not aware. When you're dreaming also, it's an automated mechanical process, right? It's not like you're consciously dreaming. It just happens on its own. Okay. Imagination cannot be controlled. You cannot channelize it. You cannot be aware of it. You cannot drive your imagination. It just is. It just automatically just keeps happening on its own. So it is considered to be tamasic, particularly when it goes into the realm of fantasy. It can be cut by the buddhi and it gives, that's what gives rise to creativity, solutions, etc. But it can also, you can get into a fancy. That's why vikalpa is seen as a double-edged sword. So these are the broad vrittis of chitta. And I think we've more or less covered what we had to cover in this particular episode of the podcast.
That is covering a fair bit of territory, and I think we might even want to pick some strands that we have kept open from this episode in the subsequent ones.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, thanks a lot, Ramana. And as for our audience, definitely we will get back to you. Please send your feedback, we would love it. And we will see what we can do next. Thank you.
Thank you.